You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a botanical garden in Green Bay highlights the story of ocean pollution with artworks made from ocean pollution. We'll visit the Washed Away exhibit, including the debut of Stanley, the lake sturgeon. Now, last week, the U.S. House of Representatives voted in favor of creating a commission to study the January 6th violence at the Capitol. 35 Republicans in Congress voted with Democrats in favor of the proposal modeled on the 9/11 commission. But its future in the Senate looks doubtful. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
What is clear is that House Democrats have handled this proposal in partisan bad faith, going right back to the beginning. From initially offering a laughably partisan starting point to continuing to insist on various other features under the hood that are designed to centralize control over the commission's process and its conclusions in Democratic hands.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see an independent investigation of the insurrection by a 9/11 style commission? All of Wisconsin's Republican representatives voted against the commission. Do you support that choice? What questions do you have about what they're trying to do here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at law and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again, and thank you to the audience.
Well, this is a congressional action here, so I'm assuming there's some complicated detail. But broad strokes, David, what in its current form would this commission look like if it were passed as is?
If it were passed as is, it would be a bipartisan commission that would have fact-finding authority and be able to put together information regarding what actually happened leading up to the events of January 6th. What do we know about January 6th? And perhaps recommendations going forward in terms of how we should address these actions in the future. So again, as you pointed out in sort of the opening here, the model was the 9/11 commission, of which most people say was absolutely, let us say, impeccable in terms of its ability to look at the causes and consequences of the terrorist attacks back in 9/11.
We just heard Senator McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, saying, you know, maybe this idea is okay, but it's so partisan in the way it's been presented by the House Democrats and the version that ultimately passed. Are there valid concerns that Democrats would be stacking the deck here?
I don't think the concerns are valid in this situation here. What's been interesting is to look at January 6th after Congress reconvened to finish verifying the electoral vote count. We saw people like Lindsey Graham and a host of other Republicans strongly condemn what happened that day. But since January 6th, really at the behest of Donald Trump and his wing of the Republican Party, there's been a significant backpedaling away from the concerns about January 6th, oftentimes claiming that you had Black Lives Matters or other groups involved in the events there. And the reason why I mention all of this is that what we're seeing now is an investigation which is focusing on what happened on January 6th. There's nothing in the mandate that says that it can't expand to include any possible sources or any possible groups that might have been involved in terms of what happened on January 6th. But what's actually happening instead is the Republicans are specifically mandating and saying, well, it has to include, for example, particular things such as investigations into Black Lives Matters and so forth. So in many ways, the Republicans are being a little disingenuous here, claiming that the Democrats are stacking the deck when, in fact, the Republicans are backpedaling from their initial concerns. Many of them are, let's say, the leadership, and they're trying to sort of force a direction for the commission. And it's also important to remember, as again, you pointed out in the introduction here, is that there were 35 Republican House members who supported this legislation. So it actually can claim, at least to be in the House, to be serious bipartisan proposal and not merely, let's say, perfunctory, where we get like maybe one Republican supporting it.
One more Republican critique, including from Kevin McCarthy, minority leader on the House side of things, says this would effectively duplicate work already going on at the Justice Department and then congressional committees looking into the security breaches at the Capitol. So why would we need this separate investigation given those existing investigations would be the argument?
Sure. Those other investigations are going to be criminal in nature. This is taking us, at least theoretically, beyond criminal in nature, looking at perhaps other issues that surrounding the January 6th events. And it's not uncommon for Congress also to do fact-finding under its investigatory powers, of which then that produces legislation, or that information that is eventually turned over to the Justice Department for criminal consideration. So this is not an unusual pattern. And again, remember that this could also lead to legislation, not just perhaps criminal indictment or criminality.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota, looking at efforts led by Democrats, some Republican support, but probably not enough of the Senate to have a commission, a 9/11 style commission to investigate the January 6th events at the U.S. Capitol. You could join in with your thoughts on that or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Larry is with us in Kingston. Larry, hi.
Hi. Yeah. I believe that there should be an investigation. The Republicans, they think about what happened at the Capitol like it was a walk in the park, and it was white supremacy going crazy. And I think that some of the legislatures and maybe even Donald Trump might have been involved in organizing it.
Larry, thanks for the call. David, first of all, Larry's saying he's worried that some members of Congress are saying he used the phrase walk in the park, downplaying it. He's also concerned about members of Congress. What kind of things could this investigation look like on those two spheres?
Well, what it would do would look at, for example, who was actually involved. Because, again, I think what the caller said, this was orchestrated by white supremacists. Well, we would be able to look, that is, the commission would be able to look into, who was behind it. Additionally, we've seen over the last few months allegations that members of Congress were involved or the Capitol Security was involved. Again, a lot of this right now is kind of anecdotal or rumor. And so a commission like this, if constituted properly, could get to the heart of a lot of these rumors and find out how this was orchestrated. How did it occur? Was there any complicity or plotting with members of Congress or, let's say, the White House back when Donald Trump was president? Again, right now, with so many rumors out there, this is really an effort to get to the truth of it and perhaps dispel this. And so for many people who are Trump supporters, they should actually embrace this commission because they have argued, for example, that Donald Trump and the White House had no involvement in this whatsoever. And if that's true, this investigation should be able to produce that as a conclusion.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. David, a lot of the attention, understandably, on the breach of the Capitol, the violence there. Could this commission look at the protest itself? Because it's unusual, I think, a sitting president convening a rally, even if it had stayed peaceful, the intent was to persuade the vice president and members of Congress to change the outcome of the presidential election in favor of the sitting president. I don't know. That is kind of a breach of precedent, isn't it?
It is a breach of precedent. Generally, we've been able to see, with the exception possibly of a couple of situations, that presidents accept the election results, move on, and don't really try to interfere with the counting of the electoral votes. I mean, just think about two instances within all of our lifetimes. 2000, where Al Gore is vice president presiding in 2001 over the counting of the electoral votes that showed that George Bush won and not he, despite the fact that there was questions regarding the validity of the results in Florida, and he performed his duties. What I'm getting at here is that this is very unusual what the president did. Very unusual the fact that what? I mean, as so many things with the Trump administration, his call for action that day, the resulting efforts to impeach him a second time. There are a lot of precedents, pardon any pun here, that were broken, you know, during the previous president's tenure, maybe some written, maybe some unwritten norms. And I think part of what a good investigation needs to do is ask, you know, the whys, you know, and again, this may be a broader way of thinking about this investigation too. It is political in terms of understanding the political roots of what's happening. I don't mean partisan, but understanding why the protests, why the anger, how all this came about. And again, perhaps trying to think in terms of how we might present or prevent something like this in the future. I mean, we forget about the fact that what? This was the first time, I think, that the U.S. Capitol had been stormed or sacked, I think, since what? The War of 1812. Now, a listener might be able to call in and correct me on that. I think the Capitol was attacked in the War of 1812, and I don't think it ever actually was during the Civil War. But the point being, this is how rare something like this is, and it's really worthy of an investigation.
We're talking about the proposed commission to study the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. David Schultz is with us, professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think Congress should do when it comes to looking at the January 6th violence? How would you like Wisconsin senators to vote on that commission? If and when it comes to a vote, you could join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with political scientist David Schultz, looking at the idea of an independent commission to investigate the January 6th events at the U.S. Capitol. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he'd bring the commission to a vote in the Senate where it would need 60 votes to pass. A lot of questions if there'd be enough Republicans to put it over that margin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a commission like this? What should be the scope, if so, of an investigation? What questions do you have about the politics or policy behind it all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, thank you. I definitely think this is a teachable moment in our country. The insurrection to me was valid. The first patriots, they overthrew the king. We also had a civil war in the mid-1800s. I think I'm not afraid of an investigation. I want to make 2 points. One is, the protesters were only overthrowing one branch of government. Even if they succeeded, Congress would have been disabled, but we still have an executive branch and a judicial branch. They would have not overthrown the government. So they need to express the point of view of the protesters, interview them, why they did it, why they chose to be civilly disobedient, what was their purpose, what was their plan. And also, I think that when it comes to the future, if anything, Congress needs to make a decision about what happens if Congress is overthrown. And the people have a right to overthrow their government. It's in our Declaration of Independence. If our government doesn't represent us, that's within our prerogative to do so. And so I think they have a valid point of view. I just hope the investigation represents both points of view.
And Jeff, you started by saying you believe the insurrection was valid. Do you mean you hoped that they had succeeded and made Donald Trump the winner of the election?
I wasn't afraid if they had succeeded, but even if they had succeeded, it was a whole nother series of events that would have had to happen for Trump to maintain his presidency. The Electoral College went ahead and made their decision. If that was not allowed to happen, because it happens in Congress, they would have found another way. And I think the other two branches of government would have sustained the rule of law. And I don't think Trump incited the violence. I think these people made their own choices. But look, every American has a right to have themselves representative in the government.
Jeff, thanks for the call. David, what do you think?
Well, first off, I would probably question the characterization of these people as being, what, civilly disobedient. I'm not exactly sure that breaking into the Capitol with the damages that they did and what also resulted in terms of what some of the confrontations that happened as to be civil. I think of civil disobedience in the classic definition is what a sit down strike, let us say at a lunch counter to protest, racism or something like that, not this kind of forcibly storming in. So I think that's one issue. The second thing is that our First Amendment rights to express our views do express a right to be able to say what we want, but we don't have a right at the end of the day to inflict harm upon others. And so while it's an interesting argument the person was making, legally and constitutionally incorrect. Now, should the commission try to figure out why they were protesting and why they engaged in the violent behavior they did? Yes. And then I guess finally to say that, well, it was only action against one branch of government, that still counts as what? An effort to try to forcefully overthrow the United States. And there's a difference between advocating versus engaging in action to do that. And by all indications, this was engaging in action to try to overthrow, even if it was only one branch of the government. So again, I'm not sure the caller's characterization of what happened that day is accurate.
Let's go to Gordon next in Madison. Gordon, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad your guest answered the prior caller so reasonably. My question is, what happens? It sounds to me like the way they're setting up the commission, the way the law is currently written, is to have it evenly divided. Suppose the commission is evenly divided and they disagree, which is likely to happen, on things like subpoenas or what information they're going to go after. The minority, which is going to be even on that commission, the way it's currently written, is going to be able to block everything essentially. So what happens? Isn't that kind of a dead end process?
Gordon, thanks for the call. And this is something we see on federal and state election commissions when they're, 3-3 ties and things like that. David, is this something that's handled in this particular commission proposal?
Well, that is a possibility. You're absolutely correct that we could see some deadlocks here. I think what's being hoped is the fact that the cooler heads will prevail, that there'll be a certain amount of compromise. Now, that may be a little optimistic, but I think that's what they're really hoping for at the end of the day, is that they'll be able to work something out like this. Now, I don't know if in the legislation it gives ultimately, let us say, the chairs, some kind of final, let us say, decision to be able to do something. But my understanding is right now is that it's going to be bipartisan, with the hope that there will be cooperation and agreement on something in terms of being able to proceed on investigations, rules, subpoenas, and so forth.
Talking to David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, about proposals for a January 6th commission, modeled in part on the 9/11 commission. Back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Beloit. Bob, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Bob?
Well, how about a little objectivity? Where's the commission for all the state and local and federal buildings that were burned down to the ground across our country all last year? Where's that objectivity? Are we having a commission for that? And you call what happened in Washington an insurrection? Was it concerted? No. People were angry. And it was really bright of them to do that. But you know what? It wasn't too bright to do what they did across the country as well, which was probably 100 times worse in magnitude as to what happened in the Capitol. Right, Professor? Oh, and by the way, so I'd like to hear what you have to say.
We're breaking up there, Bob, but go ahead, David.
Okay. It may be very well legitimate to have a separate commission to look at what happened. I think he's referring to post George Floyd, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I think so too. Okay. Back in 1967, 1968, there was something called the Kerner Commission that looked at what was supposedly the causes of urban disorder across the United States. You know, in the summers of 66, 67, there were riots across the country. And there's nothing that precludes Congress from doing that. In fact, that would probably be an incredibly good idea, is to say, where have we progressed in the past 50 years in terms of race in America, race relations in America, and maybe this time perhaps act upon some of the recommendations in the Kerner, in an updated Kerner Commission report. So again, assuming he's talking about post George Floyd, I think we probably should have some kind of serious investigation or serious discussion about that, and along with perhaps thinking about how this country handles race matters in the United States, especially race and policing. In part, the George Floyd Act, which is before Congress right now and tied up in the Senate also, aims to try to address some of those issues.
Thanks for the call, Bob. A lot of people have made that equivalence, David. The answer from some has been, well, this was an attempt to overturn presidential elections in America, and it threatened the first through third people in the line of succession to the presidency. I don't know. Is there some different level here? Is there a different level of enormity if this had come out the way the insurrectionists had intended?
I think there's something very different here. I mean, what we have to sort out here with sort of some of the post George Floyd is there was clearly legitimate First Amendment protected actions that were going on. I think nobody endorses the property destructions that occurred, but sorting out perhaps who's responsible for what there would be important. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota. We're finding that the vast majority of the individuals who caused the fires and damage in Minneapolis and St. Paul were not Black Lives Matter people. They were white supremacists and white individuals who were being convicted. So my point being there is that maybe there's validity for some investigation there, but it's certainly not the equivalent in terms of essentially trying to overturn the results of an election and to storm the Capitol, and whether it's concerted or individual, to be able to halt the democratic process from moving forward. And so it may be worthwhile finding out, because some of your listeners are asserting and saying, well, this wasn't concerted. We don't know. And that's partly why to have a commission, to find out, was it concerted? Was it random? I find it difficult to believe that you could just have thousands of people just sort of randomly show up and undertake the type of activity they did.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you to the listeners and the callers.
That's David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota joining us for a look at a proposed commission to study the January 6th insurrection. Coming up, a national project turns garbage and debris found in waterways into large-scale sculptures. We'll find out how you could see them in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the trading card business boomed during the pandemic. We'll find out what it's meant for prices, the chances of fraud, and where it's left casual collectors. Now, an exhibit that's made stops at places like the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and SeaWorld is in Wisconsin for the first time. The exhibit is called Washed Ashore, Art to Save the Sea. It opened at the Green Bay Botanical Garden earlier this month. It features sea animal sculptures made from something unexpected, trash. Angela Hazeltine-Potsey is the founder and artistic director of the nonprofit Washed Ashore Project. Angela, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Linda Gustke is director of education and guest experience at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Linda, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks, Rob.
Well, Angela, give us the basic idea, the concept behind this project, please.
Well, Washed Ashore started about 11 years ago, and with the idea I had that if people just saw how much garbage was washing up on our beaches and realized what was happening in the ocean and actually saw it in a way that they couldn't ignore it, then they would take action to help solve the problem. And no better way than I can think of is than to use the arts as a powerful language. And so I decided to use the idea of the animals that are affected by the plastic pollution in the ocean and waterways. And really, that's what Washed Ashore is all about. And the Great Lakes is part of that. And then make them gigantic so that people can't just walk by them, but go, what? What's that? Where? What is that? I need my picture taken next to it. And then what is it about? And then they see objects that they can recognize in their own usage in life and stop and think about, well, maybe I am buying too much plastic, or maybe I'm throwing away too much plastic, and maybe I should make some changes. So that's kind of the idea. And then we partner up with organizations like botanical gardens and zoos and aquariums around the country and partner with them to get the message out to the people and try to spark positive changes in consumer habits.
And Linda, can you paint us a radio picture of what these sculptures look like in the setting of the botanical garden there?
Oh, wow. Just so imagine flowers, of course, at a botanical garden, and then emerging from them are these larger-than-life sea animal creatures. They're very vibrant in color. And as you, when you're far away, all you see is that big, big animal. So a shark that's, you know, swimming away, or a flash the marlin, which is beautiful and colorful. And then as you get up closer, you realize all the little pieces are pieces that you recognize. There's soles of shoes, there's toys, there's hairbrushes, all this plastic that you're using and don't really always think about where it goes after you're done with it.
Angela, what kind of response have you gotten from people who have seen and come in and saw the close-up, all the material that ends up in the ocean? What kind of things do you hear from people about the stuff they use?
Well, I think that, you know, people are really sometimes shocked that there's so much of it, and that it's stuff that, you know, it's not somebody else's fault, but they use that same stuff they're seeing. You know, if it's a Bic lighter, or if it's a toothbrush, or you know, maybe it was a can or a water bottle, and they're like, well, I didn't really think about that as being an issue, but it is, because it's ending up in the ocean. And I think that, you know, they're meant to be beautiful and horrifying and educational all at the same time. And so, you know, get a little of all of that. And hopefully and our signage is really important as well. Gives you action points that you can take today to help solve the problem. And also it gives you a kind of a fun way of a scavenger hunt of things that you can look for and look more carefully at, which is really fun for kids too, as well as adults.
And Linda, I understand one of the sculptures is brand new, making its debut in Green Bay, Stanley the Sturgeon. Can you tell us about Stanley?
Yes. So most of these creatures you will see are creatures from the ocean. And so we wanted to have something to tie back to our area, to our region. And in the Fox Valley and Green Bay area, sturgeon spearing is a big topic and a really important pastime that's here and part of our history. So, and the sturgeon was a really great fit. We really just wanted to make sure that we're tying that theme of plastic pollution. You know, it's not just happening in the oceans, as Angela mentioned, it's happening right here in our Great Lakes. So we wanted to make sure that we were tying it back home as well. So really excited. Stanley is one of the first sculptures that you will see. And like you said, it's making its debut here at Green Bay Botanical Garden. It's been seen nowhere else.
Angela, can you talk about the value of taking the exhibit on the road? You've been at some big name institutions. You've got a documentary about the Washed Ashore project. What makes you want to go to, come here and visit us in Wisconsin, for example?
Well, you know, we just need to reach everybody. And so we're constantly, we actually have 4 traveling exhibits that tour the country all the time. And when I started this, I was like, well, it can't just be in one place. It's just got to keep moving and it has to keep reaching people. So we've calculated that about 35 million people have actually seen our work in person in the last 11 years, because we never just put the stuff in storage. We're always traveling it to another place and another place. And that's really important to make the kind of change that we really believe in. And really in 11 years, I've seen a huge amount increase of talking about and understanding and taking action against plastic pollution in the water. And I'd like to think that we had something to do with that. But
And Linda, as we wrap up, can you let us know how and when people can check out the exhibit?
Yes, the exhibit is here at Green Bay Botanical Garden now through September 26th. It's included with admission, and we are open daily from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. So whenever you come visit the garden, that includes a visit to Wash to Shore, again, from now through September 26th.
Linda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us, and we're looking forward to seeing everybody at the garden soon.
And Angela, thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Angela Hazeltine-Potsey is founder and artistic director of the nonprofit Washed Ashore Project, and Linda Gustke is director of education and guest experience at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, where they are exhibiting one of the collections of sculptures made from ocean pollution. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about robots.
The University of Wisconsin-Madison has always been a leader in research and innovation. And in the last year, the campus has seen an inventive approach to food service. WPR's Norman Gilliland has the story.
If you've been to Madison sometime in the past year, chances are you've seen them. Stout strangers from a strange land, about the size of a cooler, scuttling down the sidewalk on four wheels, flag raised, dodging obstacles as they go about their business. They're called Starships. They come from Estonia by way of a San Francisco-based company called Starship. There are about 35 of them in Madison, and they work for the University of Wisconsin Food Service, delivering food, mostly, to students, mostly.
Hello, here's your delivery.
Our students are coming to us, and, you know, they've grown up with Uber Eats and Eat Street and DoorDash and Grubhub and, you know, kind of all these conveniences and all of these real-time services. So when they come to us, you know, they're kind of already expecting that, right?
Peter Testore, director of dining and culinary services, probably knows more about them than anyone else in town, but even he maintains a professional distance.
Do they have names?
You know, when they first came to campus, I had dreams of putting flame stickers on there and R2-D2 stickers and naming them. And unfortunately, Starship is very strict on their branding protocols, and we're not allowed to officially name them or brand them in any way.
You might call them UROs, unidentified rolling objects. But you know, any food-bearing entity mingling with students is bound to get drawn into a relationship.
What we've seen is that students adopt them as part of the campus community, almost kind of like a campus pet. Students petting them as they drove by, students, you know, putting hats and scarves on them when it was cold outside, taking selfies with them. It's really toward at the beginning of the school year, it's new for students and for parents, right, when they come to campus to either visit or drop their student off with us, and they take selfies and pictures with the students too. So the one downside of that is during those times, delivery times can be a little long because the robots are being stopped to take a selfie with it.
And sooner or later, a relationship leads to extra favors.
Starship does have the ability to program special messages into their robots during certain holidays or other times of the year. Valentine's Day, for example, they'll wish someone a happy Valentine's Day when they drop their order off. We did a promo towards the end of last year where the robot delivered a student their cap and gown and wished them congratulations. So Starship does have the ability to put some messages in there, and not only English, but in multiple different languages as well.
Can they communicate verbally at all?
If someone is in their way, they can ask to please move. I'm working right now. So they can communicate in that way, but they can't have a verbal exchange back and forth.
How do they read the traffic lights?
You know, they use a GPS signal of sorts with sonar, radar kind of on the robots, and that's a whole lot of technical piece of the operation that I don't really understand, but they have, they're able to detect things within 6 feet around them, able to detect when a light turns green, able to detect when a car is coming, when a car is not coming. So they're 95% autonomous and 5% human driven. That's generally some of the 5% that they're human driven is when they're at a busy intersection specifically.
With so much charm going for them, it seems likely that these starships, these visitors, are here to stay.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
That was WPR's Norman Gilliland talking about the food delivery robots on the UW-Madison campus. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, we'll find out what a spike in demand for trading cards during the pandemic means for collectors and why one major retailer is pulling cards from its shelves. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Target said last week it's halting the sale of all trading cards at its stores. That includes sports cards and brands like Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh! The decision comes after an argument over cards outside of Target here in Wisconsin. In Brookfield, it happened. It turned violent, led to four arrests earlier this month. Trading cards have been in higher demand during the pandemic, driving up prices and the chances of fraud. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a card collector, maybe a card dealer? Have you seen a change in the business over the last year? How do you feel about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jacob Bogage covers business and the U.S. Postal Service for the Washington Post. Jacob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Rob.
I don't currently collect these things. I did as a kid for baseball cards and whatnot. I've missed a big story here. This business is out of hand. What's going on, Jacob?
You've given up the dream. I've got my cards sitting right here on my desk. And when I get bored, I flip through them and see if I can put together a decent lineup as a baseball geek. Yeah, this is a hobby that everyone kind of thinks when they grow out of it, it's gone away. Baseball card collecting has been going strong for years and years and years. And Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh! And other kinds of games and collectibles have made it just as strong. And you have to think about it not as much as a hobby and more as collectibles. And so you find people like me who every time, I guess when Target used to sell cards, would pick up a pack of cards just to sweeten having to, you know, make a run to pick up a plunger or something. to folks who view these things as investments, who want, you know, there's a huge distinction in the card community in baseball cards, like pre-World War II to post-war. So there's all kinds of folks in between who do this for fun, who do it with their kids, who do it with their parents, who do it as an investment, who are involved in other sorts of games and collectibles. And it's a big industry.
And there are apparently flippers out there who, you know, don't just go to Target for that plunger. They wait for whatever store to get their delivery, go in, buy them up, and sell lots of these cards.
Yeah, that's what we've seen, especially during the pandemic, with people kind of retreating to old hobbies or other ways to invest, if it's not the stock market, is flippers who will wait until they'll even memorize when a vendor shows up at a big box store with cards. They'll go in, they'll buy the entire inventory, and they'll open them up and see what's valuable and what players are hot or what cards are hot and try to flip them online for up to four or five times their value. That has created a lot of tension in this hobby. And we still don't know exactly what the circumstances were around this altercation at Target in Brookfield. The district attorney in Waukesha County hasn't turned over that information yet to us. But it's leading a lot of collectors and dealers and other flippers to get worried about rising tensions to the point where folks are getting attacked over these things in the store parking lot.
Right. And I don't want to be the media guy who's, you know, tensions are inflamed, violence breaking out all over the country. This is one incident. We're not entirely clear on what happened. That said, Target's not going to carry these things anymore. What's behind that decision?
Yeah, that's a great point. And we don't want to be those folks who say, oh my gosh, you know, run for cover. Tensions are inflamed. But it does speak to potentially a larger issue that a giant big box chain like Target just says, we don't want to be involved with this anymore. You, of course, can still buy these cards online from Target. But, you know, even if it's not about violence, it still is not advantageous to a store to have folks come in, buy your inventory out, and then just turn around and sell it for X amount, you know, of the value online, because now they're controlling the supply. That's the entire point of having a big box store, is that you want to be able to control supply. So that kind of gives you a bit of a window into how larger retailers are contending with this volatile hobby.
Talking to Jacob Bogage from the Washington Post, talking about a boom in collectible cards. We're talking baseball cards, the Pokemon, that kind of thing. Prices up, demand up during the pandemic. And Jacob, with big prices comes the risk of fraud, I guess. What are we seeing out there?
Yeah, this is another one of those wild things in the hobby where folks will, they call it doctoring, or they'll doctor cards to make them look like they were cared for better than they really were. So that really comes into play if you have cards that are older or cards that are, you know, X amount of a kind, one or two of a kind, where they're worth a lot more if they look like they've been cared for a lot better. And that can be, you know, turning a $50 card into an $150 card. I wrote about a card a couple of years ago, a Stan Musial from 1952, that went from $2,800 to $28,000. And because there are so many cards floating around in the marketplace and in collectors' stashes, you don't know what's altered and what's not unless you're a really good sleuth. And the hobby does have some digital sleuths, so we'll try to track these things down and track purchases online from different marketplaces. It gets really in the weeds, and it's fascinating if you're a geek like me or if you're a card collector.
Well, and you went to another business I didn't know existed. There are trading card appraisal companies. What's life looking like for them these days?
Yeah, they play a huge part in this marketplace. You think about, you know, you have a card. You want to know, have I kept it in good condition? Have I kept it in good condition relative to other cards like it? What should the value of it be? You can go to these grading companies who will tell you, hey, this is a 10. It's in mint condition. It's perfect. Or this is a 4. Or we can tell you've altered it, so it's not worth as much. They are a huge part of this ecosystem. Keeping everybody honest. And part of the issue is, are they doing a good enough job? And so as people have retreated to these old hobbies during the pandemic, because they're stuck at home, they have gotten so much business, they've had to turn business away so they could keep their standards of quality high enough. And that has caused a surge in card value.
My kids have grown out of Pokemon now, but for those with younger kids, I mean, if they want to go to the store and buy a couple packs for their kids, can they do it now? Are stores getting cleaned out that consistently?
You know, it really depends on where you live and the kinds of stores you go to. One of the things we've seen in recent years is a resurgence of local card shops who, you know, those are geared towards collectors, but I had a card shop growing up in suburban Maryland. And, you know, when my mom went to the farmer's market, me and my brother would beg her to go get baseball cards on the way home, and she let us. So, you know, that's a great place to go. You can still buy these online at Target, and then other big box stores will have them in stock as well.
Jacob, if somebody is sitting on that collection that they've been thinking of selling for a long time, maybe the, you know, Kurt Bavakwa Topps Bubblegum Championship card, whatever their treasure is this the time to get into the seller's market?
Well, Rob, now we know what you've been sitting on. yes and no. I mean, you know, the thing that I hear from collectors and professionals all the time is collect what you love. Don't just collect because you think it's an investment, because that's the best way to get burned. If it's worth it to you to go out and have something, or to be able to talk about it with your friends or talk about it with your kids, then keep it around and think about it as an investment and something you want to, you know, keep in the family or pass down. If you're ready to move on, then these grading companies are a really nice option to make sure you know what you're doing, and that whoever's in this market with you knows what they're getting.
We'll leave it there. Jacob, thanks a lot for opening that window for us. I appreciate
it. It's such a pleasure. I love geeking out with you guys.
That's Jacob Bogage. He covers business and the U.S. Postal Service for The Washington Post. He talked to us today about a boom in the trading card business, the baseball cards, Pokemon, and more. It's driven up prices and led Target, at least, to halt card sales at its stores. If you are seeing this happen, if you're a card collector yourself, casual or serious, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR.